Stay on.
Okay, are we going? Okay. So our first, well, our only thing this afternoon is a policy session with H3S, who's sitting in the audience. So I'd like to invite Rich Swift and Jill Smith up.
Move approval.
These folks are here today to provide an update on the $1.2 million Affordable Housing and Services Fund, and specifically, is it an RFP or a Notice of Funding Availability? It's an RFP that they're putting together for getting some money into the community for good work.
I wanted to say that I was looking at this, I was reading this. Man, all those things are good when I realized I was reading your goals.
Mm-hmm.
That's good that you thought they were good.
So actually, the majority of this presentation is Jill's. I'm Richard Swift. I'm the Department Director, Health, Housing, and Human Services. And, you know, this really reflects an enormous amount of work that Jill has done with folks from the fourth floor and then also H3S staff. It is a really nice use and format for the dollars that the board has allocated towards houselessness and the housing issues that the county faces. And so what I will do is turn it over to Jill. But before I do that, I do want to start off really quickly by thanking Beth Byrne from PGA, who's been outstanding in terms of helping us with our media and our essentially advertising regarding this RFP. You'll be seeing some of that. And we're going to be stepping up a web page and a little bit of a Facebook presence and that kind of thing. So more to come on that. But with this, Jill, please.
First, thank you for the opportunity to even work on this. I've been sharing the commitment that Clackamas County has made, that you have all made to this cause broadly. And folks across our region are quite impressed, and they need to step it up to be more like Clackamas County. To start out, we pointed out a few data points that we wanted you to see that I'm not sure that you've seen recently, especially the third bullet down. Recently, there was a survey just a few months ago conducted by the Clackamas County Children's Commission for Head Start programs, and they found that of 628 preschool children who are actively enrolled in Head Start just in Clackamas County, 401, or 65%, of those families were reporting they were experiencing homelessness. And it's startling. Those are babies. Those are 3 to 5-year-olds. So those numbers are not included in any of the point-in-time counts or any of that. And so it just really, escalates this when we're talking about little kids and families. And so in recognition of that, this set-aside is even more important, and it really helps us to start involving our community and helping us to work towards solutions for this problem. And that is one of the goals that we've specifically set with this $1.2 million fund. Like Rich said, we've been having regular meetings, and we've included folks from the fourth floor. Emily's been at all of them. Dan Chandler's has been at all of them, and a group of folks in H3S, and we decided, based upon what we heard from you and from the budget committee, to set some goals that we would kind of use as qualifiers to see if we're successful or not in our first year of pushing this money into the community. And those are to begin to provide small investments, gap funding, to try to incent more affordable housing development in our community, to provide small investments in preservation of existing affordable housing. Oh, and I failed to say that we also have been providing regular updates on what we're working on here at Don's housing meeting. And we've got Commissioner Savas and Schrader that attend that, and they've been giving us regular feedback and guidance and kind of helping steer this path. One of our goals is to begin to provide small investments in potential preservation of affordable housing. Funding to incent the development of safety off the streets type alternative housing, maybe something similar to our tiny home village. Begin to make small investments in local nonprofits to have more folks at the table helping us to solve this. We can't do, government certainly shouldn't be trying to do this alone. And as I said, those are kind of our guiding principles, and we'll know if we're successful by measuring against some of those things. Also, with the general obligation bond sort of out there, if that does pass and there's more development money on the table, next year we could certainly change the focus and have it be more focused on supporting, you know, those units that are developed through services in the event that the development piece isn't as needed, or another alternative would be to focus the dollars more on the areas outside of the boundary, the metro boundary, for more of the rural areas for housing development. So that, we'll talk about that next year. The guiding principles that are on the top of the next page were included in the original documents, and you guys should all be familiar with those. But what I'm really excited to get to is an outline of project categories that will be included in the RFP. And the RFP will be pushed out into the community with a process that we've used many times in community development, very successfully, called Zoom Grants. It's very easy to use and interactive. Development or preservation of housing, $300,000 will be in that pool. All applicants will be scored based upon these indicators that are bulleted here. Safety off the streets, we're trying, and also as we go over these, I want to make sure that you know that we are, since this is general fund with no real restrictions, we're doing our best to not place restrictions on this money. We would like people to be creative. We want the community to engage and bring solutions to us that we haven't thought about. So we're trying to leave it very open and broad and not restrictive. That's the goal here. So we are scoring for a creative idea or a novel approach in most of these. There's going to be a set aside of up to $150,000 for resident services and houseless services. Resident services would be targeted at people that are housed but are very vulnerable and are, need some stability to ensure that they stay housed and are successful, as well as for veteran services to be targeted at the new, what's being called Pleasant Avenue right now, the new development that NHA is working on that will house formerly homeless veterans that will need resident services to ensure that they stay stable. We have up to 150 because I think that property is scheduled to be completed in the spring. So we may not need to use any of this year's funding on that, but we did want to have a little just in case it starts before the fiscal year ends.
Is that the Northwest Housing Alternatives Project?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then finally, houseless services up to 100,000. And the goal for, the goal really is to have nonprofits, for-profits, community partners, we're leaving it open and broad, to apply with their ideas, and we'll score them, we'll be very transparent. There will be a mechanism for everyone to receive their score and to have a debrief meeting. We also intend to have a meeting following the release of this RFP to answer technical questions with everyone, and then those answers would be published. We're doing our very best to be open, transparent, not repeat any mistakes that we've made in the past. Finally, the hope is that with your support of this, we can move forward and publish this by the end of next week. We've been working closely with PGA. We'll be pushing out this flyer that talks about that this is coming. We were just waiting for a date and to know that you were supportive of this before we did that. They've also created a website that if they have interest and they receive this, they can click and they can learn all about this. There will also be a link in the website to the Zoom grants so they can go even deeper and apply. One more thing I wanted to make sure that you were aware of is if we do have a nonprofit applying to provide services, and they had also, maybe it's a church who's applied to put some sort of alternative housing in their parking lot, and they need services to support that. They can apply in more than one category for situations like that. We also want to provide up to 3 years of funding if it's a nonprofit who's trying to establish themselves. It really is not fair to ask somebody to come in and just give them 1 year's funding. It's a big disincentive. And as long as they're continuing to meet their goals and do good work, it could receive up to 3 years.
I think this is a good pilot project. I'm a little worried about money being too thin, mm-hmm. when you might have an opportunity to make a big impact somewhere, but this is a mm-hmm. good start, and see what happens this year and then move on to maybe next year a mm-hmm. specific project that gets us over the top. I know that a lot of affordable housing projects gaps mm-hmm. can be a lot bigger than what you're proposing
yes.
here.
Yep.
But the other thing is, I don't think you've ever made a mistake.
Oh, no, not me.
No, I'm the one who makes mistakes. Jill does not make mistakes.
We have made mistakes in maybe I always say we create our own pockets of poverty with urban renewal in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think we learned a lesson there, and I think it's important that we carry that forward into the future. Ken.
Yeah, when I was reading your materials, what I didn't notice mm-hmm. in there, I liked what I did see. What I didn't notice was a program to keep people in their current housing before mm-hmm. it's too late and they end up on the street. We had a little discussion about that this morning with the idea of maybe on foreclosed properties, some of the cash that can come out of that could be available for something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot less expensive to pay somebody's rent for a couple of months while they get back on their feet and get squared away with a new job or whatever it is that they're working on, mm-hmm. or you know, they've got medical bills or something like that that threaten their housing situation. And rather than seeing them on the street for the next 4 years only and to spend a ton of money mm-hmm. only trying to get them back in and get them restabilized. So I didn't see anything in this program. Is there something like that that you can do or are doing?
Yes, and I think that's an oversight because that is an eligible activity under this program. So that is something we've talked about at many of our meetings. So I will make sure that that is added.
I thought there was $100,000 that sounded like it.
The last dollar.
It should be within the homeless services. So if or the other one, it could be even in either. And
just,
again, we're
so
trying
generic,
to be open.
It's hard to tell what that meant.
Yeah, we're trying to be very flexible. And I want to say that if we received one application that was so outstanding, and we and the committee, the scoring committee that will consist of a mixture of staff and folks serving on the housing task force, the Affordable Housing Task Force, if they felt funding that one initiative was the way to go, then we would do that. The only thing that we've said is no more than four this year, because this is new and we don't know how much administrative time or it's going to take. But we haven't committed to funding one in every category or anything, so.
When I was at the water board, what came before us was the problem that some people have, just paying their water bill,
yep.
okay, especially in rental situations. And so what we did is we set aside $5,000, mm-hmm. and then we contacted Catholic Charities to do the screening, because
mm-hmm.
we didn't want our staff to have to be in a position to say no. Mm-hmm. Obviously, their job mm-hmm. is to make, collect the mm-hmm. the money in the first place. So Catholic Charities would be the screening person people that would look at mm-hmm. the client and say, okay, yes, you can, they qualify, and then a check would be cut to help them out on their water bill. Not permanently, forever, but to
right.
get them through a hump.
Right.
So I don't know if you do something like that, but that is a way to go that takes the burden off of your staff from being the ones to have to say no to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And a third neutral party makes that decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
something
great,
to consider.
Great thought. Uh-huh. We will be putting the burden of making recommendations for who would be funding on our task force members, and then bringing that to you all to seek your support or not.
I was thinking in terms of a specific person who mm-hmm. needs a little help on their rent. They mm-hmm. would go to Catholic Charities as an example.
To a nonprofit.
And they would look at it and say, okay, yeah, you qualify.
Yep.
We can help you out at least this month or something like
yep.
that.
Yep, I love yeah. that idea. And the whole one of our goals is to engage our nonprofit partners more so in this community than they ever have been. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jill and Rich have been pretty helpful in our housing meetings with Don's in putting together a package, and retention was one of the elements mm-hmm. of that, which I think was So I understand this, as I add up your five.
Now, there is a budget at the back that I failed to point you to. As you recall, in the original request that went to the budget committee, there were some set asides that weren't going to initially be included in the money that was pushed out into the community. Those are up at the top. There's the frequent user system engagement analysis. We're contracting, that's a one-time cost this year only that we're contracting with.
Portland State.
Yeah, Portland State has left me. PSU to conduct. They've already started working on that. That'll give us the information we need to know how to invest smart next year and ongoing. They'll be working across all of our systems, corrections, sheriff's office, hospitals, and help us to actually identify our top users of systems, hopefully by name. That's the goal.
Would this, if I may, I never got my full sentence out.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I didn't point you to the back page.
Yeah, it happens. I appreciate that. So where I was going was, is that when I add up the 300,000 and the 150 and the 100,
mm-hmm.
Obviously it doesn't add up to 1.2.
Mm-hmm.
And subtracting out your set asides, mm-hmm. Help me with the budget in the back now. And so the 300K for development and preservation housing is that under housing development on your back page?
Yes, yeah, it is. That's housing development.
Also okay. Adds up.
That's 300,
yep.
All right? And then the 150 for resident services.
Yep, resident and veteran services. And then that's the services total.
Up there. And then the 100 for houseless services.
Mm-hmm.
That's there.
Yep.
So there is these remaining programs that mm-hmm. we're not talking about here today, correct?
Other than
of the set aside. Or are they part of what we're talking about today?
Well, the set aside includes. No, none of the ones that we just discussed are part of the set-aside.
Right, right.
Those are all, that's just discussing the funding we're pushing into the community in hopes of receiving some creative ideas from them. Without being too restrictive, we'd like to leave it as open as possible.
Okay, so where I'm going with this, if I add those two up, the 150, the 100, the 300, and the 420 in the section above,
yep.
That does not add up to 1.2. So I just want to know how you're placing that, just so I can do the math.
500 right here.
Yeah.
250 right here. 420 right here. Adds up to 1150.
And then
1170.
There's,
and then 30,000.
And
then add 30,000 is 1,200.
Then there's 30,000 non-dedicated right there.
It's just the chart's not very.
It's not. Yeah.
Right, right. So let's just take one for example. So the safety off streets
mm-hmm.
is mentioned in here, right?
It is.
But there's not a price tag. Oh, there it is right there. I'm sorry, I missed it. Okay. That helps. So I'm just trying to put all the pieces together. I missed that 200.
Yep.
That's a lot to miss.
So one thing that is, there's been supposedly a bunch of trailer parks that have sold.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that about a week ago.
If there's not just this money, maybe it's not this money, is there an opportunity for our legal counsel to make sure that we protect the residents? You know, a Wilsonville at one point did some legislative work that provided some protection for the folks in the Thunderbird mm-hmm. trailer park.
We have talked about it. There are some opportunities potentially regarding zoning changes that the county could consider. You know, it depends on whether that park is in unincorporated versus a city. And then there's also, you know, if it's unincorporated, I mean, the county could look at some code changes. You know, one of the other things we've explored is if the bond passes and Measure 102 passes, which would expand our partnerships, we might be able to look at potentially through partnership with the 501c3 of helping some of the parks with these issues. Because I think certainly what we're probably seeing at this point is the land that's easy has been, by and large, I think, acquired. So they're now moving towards land that's a little that's not as easy to acquire. That's a little bit more work, but also offers some fairly significant, nice locations in terms of development. It also means a number of people might be looking at being put out of their current residence.
Which are hundreds, there's hundreds of people just on the McLaughlin area that are in manufactured housing.
If we look at this potential impact, you're moving into the thousands in terms of total families and then the individuals that make up those families.
Is it confirmed that those have sold? Or is that still?
I think three of them have actually been acquired, and we're not sure who they've been acquired by.
And do we know the zoning on them?
Yeah, when we talked about in our meeting was that the zoning is basically they're allowed to do what they're doing, but they're not disallowed from doing other things with the property. So the zone changes that Rich was referencing there were, if you were to lock the zoning, so to speak, or make a zoning change that locks it in, and doesn't allow those other purposes, that disincentivizes someone from buying the property or flipping it for other purposes. Mm-hmm. That's the whole thing I've been trying to bring to people's attention here for the last 8 years.
Can we use our housing emergency? This is an appropriated Clackamas County too.
You could
do something about density, that if you're going to do something with a property, you have to, I don't know, have these many units or whatever you want to call them available at this price point. Is that possible with the housing emergency?
I mean, I think we have a lot of options with that housing. We'd have to look, you know, we have to do some work with county council. And of course, you know, Dan shop in terms of code, but the other piece of this is, you know, if it's bought, if it's redeveloped, the folks who are living there currently, they're moved out. And we don't have a good answer for those folk being moved out right now because they're occupying a cohort of individuals in terms of ownership where they are not going to be able to capture that price point again. It will be absolutely lost to them in terms of what it costs currently for them month to month to live versus what they'd be looking at if they are moved off that property. And we would, we do not have a lot of financial recourse to safety net those folk if that happens. I mean, we could look at some depending on their income and depending on their status, maybe some voucher catch in terms of use of voucher, but that would probably be incredibly difficult based on our waiting list. So we are trying to be in front of this as opposed to having to react.
And being supportive of the tenants trying to, you know, take ownership of it is something that has been done successfully. And that would be considered affordable housing retention, and they could apply for funding to help with that process.
The average in those parks are between $450 and $650 a month for rent.
There's nothing else out there.
Nothing else out there that you could get at that point. And that's just rent. That's not talking about sewer, garbage, water, electricity, et cetera.
But still,
So to Commissioner Fisher's question, we did discuss that about what can we exercise our current emergency status for, and you know, I threw the idea out on the table of freezing the zoning and miscellaneous things. And Dan Johnson wasn't there, but Jennifer Hughes was there, and Dan Chandler was there in the back, and Dan Chandler brought to light the likely of, was it Measure 37 claims possibly as a consequence if you do that. But as Don was saying, if you go through ways of mitigating that, it's still there's a better outcome than it would be otherwise to do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it still ends up with a better outcome, complicated one, but it really really does beg the question. I will go back when I first started researching this back before I became commissioner. There was a group called Anti-Displacement PDX. That ring a bell?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of them.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot about
them. So their goal primarily was to look at zoning changes with the city of Portland and influence with zoning changes in the city of Portland to prevent really what's happening. And they implemented some of those policies, but in my opinion, they got watered down from where they ought to be. Some of those people still exist, and some of those efforts are still there, and they came through at a housing conference I was at about a year and a half ago. And one of them is now on our housing committee. So they're there, that's what I've been trying to help unfold. And same thing with what zoning changes can we do to preserve parts of the community to prevent these kinds of things from happening. And this is just one facet, you know, of that.
If you change the zoning in a park, that, that piece of land to mobile home park only, no other possible use, you're going to have a landowner that's going to go sideways on you because you've taken away from him or her a wide variety of opportunities that no longer exist. And I'm not advocating for them. I'm simply pointing out that that would be problematic.
That's where that mission
37. What I want to know is, and I read that book you asked us to read. It, in that book, did not do one thing. It did not tell you where it's actually been successfully done, that where redevelopment has occurred without gentrification. Is there any example anywhere in this country where that's been done? Because to my knowledge, I haven't seen it yet. Because, I mean, if somebody's done it.
So are we okay with their stuff so we can let them go?
I have a question.
Okay.
So one of the values that we talked about, the budget committee, is mixed income housing, not segregated, putting people off into, all the people of need in little pocketed areas. Is that, I don't see that as a criteria here, and so I'm just wondering how the people that are going to be filling out or applying for this money will be informed of that as an element of a proposal.
We were really focused that this is such a small amount of money that we were just hoping to get an application from an affordable housing developer, to tell you the truth. But those are criteria for our own developments that we are working on, but we didn't link those criteria to this. That's easy to do. We're still in the process of creating our scoring, and we can certainly add scoring that says, are you serving mixed income population and are you outside dense poverty?
And I guess my overall thought as I look at right now and then looking off into the future, I get very concerned about government institutionalizing, in a way, substandard housing for people. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to see us say, and I know it's really popular, the tiny homes is really, really popular, but I get real concerned. It's like, we're going to create all these little tiny homes, the substandard housing for children, for families, for all of these vulnerable populations. I get real concerned about that, and I see that the tiny homes are specifically here, and it just makes me very, very nervous. I mean, I would much rather see us invest resources and how do we create incentives for people that have an extra room in their house to house a family? How can we build the support services around these challenged people so that they can be integrated into our communities and not have them segregated?
So I.
But can they answer before we move on? To see.
Well, like I said, that those are overarching development objectives that we believe in, and I believe in as strongly as you do. I am not a big fan personally of tiny homes or any kind of substandard housing. It's transitional housing that is only needed right now because we're in a state of emergency. Otherwise, I wouldn't want to put a penny there personally. But unfortunately, we're in a state of emergency and people are living on the streets. So we're asking for creative ideas. And, maybe what we should do is name a few more creative ideas other than tiny homes. Some of the ones that you suggested, such as sharing a room in your home. Because that is something that we're testing right now in social services. So
it's something we have certainly, we debate this, and I am not instinctively drawn to tiny homes. I, like anyone else, like my space. And we also spend a fair amount of time discussing equity and how do we create opportunities for equity. And that's something that Commissioner Humberston has touched on and I want to build on a little bit. And I know that you want to get us out of here. So we debate this all the time. And so we are caught between the pragmatic realities of now and where we would like to be in the future. And so it's always a balance of how do we spend now and how do we react to the now? We're already gearing up for winter. There's some very, very, it sounds juvenile to say this, but neat. I mean, it is just so cool in terms of some of the things we've got set up for the oncoming winter, where we have trained houseless folks to become volunteers, and actually in some ways paid staff across are warming shelters this coming winter. It is, and so we'll be talking more with you all about that. It is really very cool. And so we are constantly caught in this balancing act of the now versus where we would like to be. And so we are trying really hard to make sure that against the now, we are looking forward to looking in the future of how we spend money and how we allocate those dollars to for sustainability. So related to that equity project, I've talked to the county assessor about us doing early identification of individuals who are having problems with their taxes. And how do we move into that space and resolve that? And then also, we started having some conversations about homes that are foreclosed on. Do we have an opportunity related to this? And I've already called it in my head the Clackamas County Equity Project, which is, can we, is there an opportunity for us to take those homes and actually use those in an equity project for individuals to occupy those homes, maybe for a period of time, build equity, and I don't know, have all the technical details worked out and how we would do this, but then create an equity proposition for those individuals. They could then leverage their participation in that house to a permanent domicile for themselves. Right. And because every year we have either dirt or we have actual properties that we look over, and because we're given that list. But one of the things that it's a little bit of a money problem for us, because sometimes they have tax liens, et cetera, that need to be resolved. And so we're looking into that. So we're going to get a meeting with the assessor. But one of the key pieces there is identifying people who are having problems with their taxes very early, because we've had situations where folks actually had the money to pay the taxes, and they just didn't. And there were some behavioral health issues, other things going on in that household that we actually, if we'd been notified way earlier, we actually could have stepped in and resolved.
So this is a tender spot, frankly, with me. So the advocates, elected officials and builders and occupants and buyers that are seeking and proud that they live in a tiny home, mm-hmm. with all those facilities, they're proud of that.
Right.
And for us to call that substandard, it's a slap in the face to everyone, frankly. So I'd really like to know what the definition of what's above substandard. I mean, because frankly, there's dignity in owning a home. There's dignity in living in a place with plumbing and with electricity and a place that you're comfortable with. And the people we saw in Eugene, the people we see here that live in those things, they're happy, they have pride, they have their dignity, and they don't want to be in a subsidized facility or a government subsidized facility. So that's a tender spot. So whether it's Rich or whether it's Sonia or someone define to me, what is substandard?
I think that's in the eye of the beholder, quite frankly.
Well, it's not for us to call.
That's my point. It's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, for my wife and I, we sometimes think about what would we have done, knowing what we know now, 50 years ago when we got married. You know what we would have done? We'd have bought a pickup truck with a great big camper on it, until we could find a piece of land that we could camp on. And then we would have built our own house from the ground up, and we would not have paid a bank a dime in interest rates. So would I live in something like that for 7 years in order to build my own house and not have to pay that bank all that interest? Yeah, I'd do that, and I wouldn't consider that substandard. So it really is situational. If I had to have somebody move into my house and live with me and my wife, that would be substandard housing to me. Mm-hmm. Because I like living in a single family home, just my wife and my son. So, but making sure that people are in shelter that is warm, that has running water and sewer and electricity and the basics, whether that's 400 square feet, 900 square feet, 1,500 square feet, or 10,000 square feet, I think that depends on the eye of the beholder as to what's sufficient. Mm-hmm.
So there's a manufactured home park owner around Joe Van Haverbeck, mm-hmm. who for years has advocated if we had the land, he could make it happen. Affordable manufactured home parks. There are a lot of them in Clackamas County. Oregon City is actually probably one of the best areas I've ever seen that has a lot of them. But if we had a site, he could put the housing in, and manufactured homes are not substandard. I live in a substandard house right now.
I agree.
But it won't be, but, I mean, if we owned a piece, if we had an opportunity to tax foreclosure to get 5 acres in a place we could develop a manufactured home park, that'd probably be the best thing we could do. But then again, you don't want to create pockets of poverty either, so that's where you got to be really careful.
Well, that's where we need the city's cooperation, and that's where we need to make sure we're not concentrating, you know, that into areas. I mean, you know,
is Joe in the city?
No, he's just on the edge, unincorporated, unincorporated. And Joe's one of them. There are several very well clean, well kept parks that where they have a high standards. They're local owners. They're compassionate. They're not out there trying to twist the rents up to a point. So they're doing a great job. But they're both passed away. But I had an aunt and uncle who had a huge nest egg. They could have lived anywhere they wanted to live. And oddly enough, they chose because they were shrinking in life. At that point in time in life, they wanted just to scale things down. And they chose to buy a manufactured home, and they lived there until they passed. And they loved their little place. It was cute. They took pride in it. And they had the wherewithal to buy anything and live anywhere they chose. They had a sizable nest egg. And so I just knowing a lot of people that grew up in very small little places, they're proud of what they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you guys want to respond to what Commissioner Sevis said?
So I'd like to know what substandard is. I mean, so, Sonia, you brought it up Thursday, you brought it up today. I'd like to know what substandard is.
My concern as a society is that we as government should not create pockets of where people are socialized in certain areas that are I would consider it substandard. I know that some of what we went to visit when we were in Eugene, where they do certain construction of smaller places, I wouldn't consider that substandard. I would consider that sort of a pocket community. But our sleeping pods, which the reasons why those are there, definitely substandard.
Well, it's a shelter.
Yeah.
That's what shelters are. They're not housing.
I just get concerned with those kinds of things being concentrated and blessed. So
yeah.
If we're looking at women and children, I don't want to see them in sleeping pods.
I would agree.
I don't want to see substandard housing for these populations. I don't like, we've known this throughout history, that when you concentrate certain categories of people, you do not have good societal outcomes. So it's those kinds of philosophies that we are setting this up, and we're saying, hey, here's some money, go forth, think about this. We are the ones that set those standards, and we have an opportunity.
You know, I don't know that I have an answer for this question. I appreciate Commissioner Savis's reminder, because we always, for myself, I need to be mindful of the values I bring to it that are my personal values versus and making sure that I'm not inflicting those upon others. I do believe that one of the things that we see often in some of our development, how we think is, does our development allow folks to pursue, the people we're working with, to pursue options, to have choice. When you remove or narrow or eliminate choice and options, that's when you begin to have socialized poverty, where folks, their horizon is down here because they are so concerned with how to walk the sidewalk and how to do the next thing. You know, Vahid was working with a family where literally the mom, 3 kids, every day she was out sign sailing, which is, you know, panhandling, making about $80, maybe $100 a day, doing this every day despite the weather, and keeping her kids housed, and they're going to school, and that's what she was doing. Her choice is that. That's what she saw for herself. And so now we've actually paid forward her hotel, and we're working on moving them into more permanent housing so that she can then pick her head up, look around, and pursue other options. And so for me, that's, I think, what we talk about, you know, in terms of, is housing substandard or is it something that permits someone the appropriate view of their horizon? And I don't know, and I guess we could probably spend a fair amount of time putting in criteria and identifying different things that allow us to establish whether something's substandard or not. But, you know, I feel like part of it's our interaction with the community and the individuals and being mindful of making sure that we're permitting them their voice and they can say, this is my choice. I wish to live here and I am completely good with it and this is why, versus folks who say, you know, and we have this actually in our housing authority now where folks aren't, because of socialization, are unable to pick up their eyes and look and see what is in front of them in terms of their horizon.
So I appreciate that, Rich. I think I want to give, I really want to get some understanding about this, because when we say concentrate, I mean, there are people that are critical about being concentrated into a subsidized facility, call it whatever, anyone that we operate, you know, that's three or four stories, and it's all subsidized housing, right? Or it's Section 8 housing, they're concentrated, right? And you could argue that's concentrated. Or is it concentrating an entire city? Or is it concentrating a block? Or in a certain part of town where we don't put it in the ritzy parts of town, but we put it in the other. I just want to get some idea what we mean when we say concentrating, because we're building concentrated housing, right?
Because it's the least expensive.
But I don't define that as concentrated. I define concentration as saying, you know what, we're going to put it all over here, and we're not going to sprinkle it throughout. I think that's what we hear in the region, that there's an equal distribution of that. The word concentration isn't being used. So I just want to get definition and understanding of how we, the terms we use and how we use them, because I think that we do. We do need, our cities need to step up and say, we're going to zone parts of their city to allow some of that housing to take place there. And it's an incentive with that particular house. If we don't, then we're all part of the problem.
So I could answer all your questions with government definitions and tell you what they all mean, but really, because there is a definition for concentration of poverty and substandard housing. But that's all for federal dollars. And I think Rich is right. I think that if people have choice and they're happy, maybe the housing isn't substandard. But there is an overlay when it's government that is creating something. That how do we define decent, safe, and sanitary housing? And generally, it's somebody that has the ability to have bathroom facilities, a minimal ability to prepare food, even if it's just a microwave and a countertop and a cabinet, and a safe place to sleep. I mean, that's it, basically, in a nutshell. So a tiny home without those things, per government definition, would never qualify for any kind of subsidy or, you know, federal dollars. So.
It may be actually a useful question to the Housing Task Force.
Yeah.
Get their head on it.
If I guess I look at it, we have X amount of dollars that we could spend on housing people that need help.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
If I can get 2,000 people in housing, and by my standard, it might be substandard. But it's warm, it's dry, it has a bathroom, it can do the basic cooking, et cetera. Or I can build a whole bunch of houses like I like to live in, and that'll take care of 250 people. I think I'd rather get the 2,000 people undercover. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what we face. In the final analysis, though, your handout today says it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the very first square. What's happened to rents versus what's happened to wages? Will not solve the entire problem.
Right.
All we can do is patchwork as much as possible for those that are the most needy to the best of our ability. And until wages catch up, we're going to be faced with this problem.
Right, and I just want to say it's a human crisis. I don't think it's really a housing crisis, because we need to invest in the humans so that they can make up some of that gap in wages and focus on the folks who don't have the ability to do so, which is our seniors and our disabled population.
Yep. Those people are employed. So that box doesn't speak to all of it.
No,
okay,
but it speaks to some of it.
People that are disabled and can't work,
yeah.
And the people that are senior citizens that aren't going to work,
yeah.
They're not, wages is just, it's not part of their financial equation.
You're right.
I understand.
Okay, it's the cost of housing. It's a flat cost of housing going up. And we need to be part of the solution and not be part of the problem. And we need to get in this mode where we are at least preventing and not being part of the problem and do no harm. And that's I don't think we're there yet. I'm kind of concerned that you know, and I'm back to the metro thing a little bit. I mean, not, we talked about it today, but this, some of the, I'm concerned that, if we keep on doing it their way, or we doing it in these TOD-type models, transportation-oriented development, so that that's the most expensive darn areas that there are. And we actually displace, we actually do more harm than we'll ever do with any kind of money we could ever foresee the taxpayers paying or passing.
Can I just ask a question on it? How are we tying housing to public health?
We've got public health actually at the table with us, and just like they did a health, what did they call their analysis they did at the village? Health impact assessment.
Yeah.
As we constructed the village, they gave us, they did a bunch of research, did best practice analysis, and we're going to come together and see how we did. They're also participating in the Milwaukee site, Hillside Manor, and all of that work that's going on in planning. They're part of that planning to help us make healthy decisions for the people, to long term, for the community too. We're doing our best to pull them in.
Is there any money available through public health?
No.
No?
No. I wish.
I suppose getting back to the point at hand, your proposal is fine.
Thanks.
As least far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
I suppose you should. You kind of deserved an answer to that question, I think.
So we can push it out the end of next week?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like to see just more creative sites.
Okay, we'll add some other examples.
We can absolutely do that.
And I'm happy to add that we would really like to see developments that are outside of dense poverty zones, which is defined by the census tract, and people, I think it's in excess of 20% of the folks residing in that census tract are at or below poverty. I think that's the definition, if I remember correctly. So we can add some of those things in there and say we'd prefer to see applications and even score a little bit higher, because that those are great things.
I think it's important now that we are going to be funding a housing assessment that we don't make mistakes until we have the answers. So I think that's, and I assume the RFP or RFQ is out for that, or is Portland State or somebody doing that?
The FUSE analysis, you know, will help us.
That one.
Yes.
Oh,
Dan.
And so one other thing, you know, related to public health, as we head into flu season, please get your flu shots.
Get your shots, yeah.
Yes, last year was a very tough flu season.
Yeah,
so
you do. My son's
please.
Back east, and he just has the flu today, so.
Mike's not working. Oh, a housing needs assessment.
Oh, are you doing that now?
But that mic's not working.
Yep.
Use that one. Steal his.
All right, I'll see you later.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks, Jill.
Yeah, the contract's at procurement right now. They've been selected. They're ready to go, working on the IGA with the LCD because they're funding 100,000 of it. To kick off meeting should be within 10, 12 days from now.
Awesome.
Thanks.
You bet.
That was fast.
All right. With anything else?
Don't have anything else.
All right. Thank you very much.
Darn thing.
We'll see you tomorrow. See, you're going to the mountains.